You're listening to the NASM CPT Podcast with Rick Ritchie, the official podcast of the National Academy of Sports Medicine.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the NASM CPT Podcast. My name is Rick Ritchie, and this is a podcast where we try to help inform, develop, and refine fitness professional skills when it comes to exercise and human movement science, metabolic health, coaching, and the business of training. So if you wouldn't mind, join us and give us a listen, a like, a share, subscribe, and review. That would be appreciated. And I'd like to welcome our guest for today and our topic for today. So the guest of the day, if you listen to the podcast, is not new to the podcast. If we were SNL, he would be NASM CPT Podcast's Alec Baldwin. He has been a guest on a show so many times, and the reason he is because he's so good at it. So ladies and gentlemen, welcome my friend, colleague, Dr. Scott Cheatham. Hi, Scott.
Hey, hi, everybody. Thanks for having me again, Rick.
I love it. I love having you on. You're just such a wealth of information. You provide such good content. And from time to time, you just make me chuckle. So it's always good to have you on. And today, we're going to talk about something that is no laughing matter, but in the process of it, we will have a good time and we will help to inform and educate the personal trainers that are out there listening to this podcast regarding COVID-19. And one of the things that NASM has done is developed a course for and about COVID-19 and how to manage COVID-19, not just as an individual, not just as a trainer, but it could also be like facility management and things like that. How do you deal with COVID-19? So as we're producing this course, and we are about, I think we're 18 months at the time of this recording, 18 months after the initial shutdown where everything happened. And we're still dealing with this stuff. And this course is as applicable now as it was early on in the pandemic. So talk to us a little bit about the course, what's to be expected. And then I want to get into kind of my favorite topic about the course, which is the correlation between physical activity and COVID-19, which I recently did a podcast about, but they were like, Scott's going to be on. And I was like, oh, let's let him talk about it because he's smarter than me. So we're going to have you do it.
Well, first of all, your pod discussion was fantastic because it covered, you know, quite the essential information in the course. So what NASM did was we set out to kind of give an update to the fitness professional on how to manage clients with, you know, who either, you know, the post COVID-19 client. So basically we created 6 chapters that cover everything from, you know, kind of like the epidemiology of the virus, you know, where it began and how it progressed around the world so quickly with how it impacts the fitness industry. And then we moved on to facility management. You know, what are the current best practices for facility owners and fitness professionals within different settings, even including outdoors, limited indoors, and also one-to-one. Then also we went a bit deeper into the literature, into best practices, and we have a really comprehensive discussion on managing the post COVID-19 client. And I think, as you mentioned too in your podcast, there's a lot of signs and symptoms that come with post COVID-19, but there's also a lot of long-term complications. So we go very in depth into that. And then the last few chapters, we get into using technology to really help us monitor the post COVID-19 client during their exercise programs. So we get into some of the kind of nerdy devices like the pulse oximetry to measure their oxygen levels, or, you know, looking at their, you know, being able to use one of these tracking providers that we have, you know, all the tracking devices to really look at their sleep schedule or how they're doing as far as stress management and stuff. So, you know, we had some of our experts who authored the chapters really provide a deeper look into the current evidence using this technology with COVID-19 clients. And then we also covered some of the more prevention and wellness strategies. And Rick, I think this is what you were referring to, was that, you know, we talk about the importance of exercise, but also some of the mindfulness strategies and some of the other wellness strategies that are in the literature, and that over this last year, we're finding to have good results with post-COVID-19 clients or just healthy individuals who've suffered with, you know, isolation and some form of depression or mental health issues because of the COVID-19. So again, chapter five goes into a little bit more broad perspective of working with post-COVID-19 clients, but also healthy individuals who've been challenged over this last year. And then the last chapter we went into is we kind of suggest some business strategies that kind of help support the NASM's new virtual training course that came out a few months ago. Okay. And also giving some suggestions on how to, you know, promote yourself online and some best practices when it comes specifically to the post-COVID-19 client. One thing I think it's important to mention too is that for a lot of fitness professionals or even healthcare professionals like myself, if I'm functioning as a physical therapist, we're seeing a lot of post-COVID-19 survivors. So a lot of these individuals can have these long-term complications up to 6 months. At least that's what the literature is telling us. And so, you know, a lot of these chapters are giving the fitness professional different pearls of dealing with these clients, because in my humble opinion, it's going to be a growing market for fitness professionals, because as we'll talk about here later on in the podcast, how important exercise is, and the best trained professional for that is a fitness professional. I mean, yeah.
Ooh, that is a clip right there, because I look for ways where fitness professionals can feel like they are more engaged and more in part of these conversations, and more important than sometimes people or even ourselves, more important than we give ourselves credit for, because sometimes we just look at it and say, hey, am I putting together something a couple times a week to help somebody exercise, to feel better, function better, and maybe get their blood pressure down or their cholesterol down or lose weight and all of these things. And I think they're really valuable. But we don't put that together sometimes with health outcomes. We just kind of put them together with fitness outcomes. Like, did my VT1, VT2 increase? Is my VO2 max getting better? Am I doing better on my Harvard step test or whatever it is? My weight and my PR is going up. But we don't look at this very often and say, how am I supporting people in their metabolic health or in their cardiorespiratory health? And with that being said, there was a study, and I want to talk about it. So it was done by Mattioli et al. And it talks about the way that diet changed and physical activity changed throughout the quarantine COVID-19. And it ended up increasing significantly the cardiovascular or the risk for cardiovascular disease. So some people, and the study I pointed out in the podcast that I did the other day, some people did better physically active during quarantine, but the majority of people less active, more sedentary, and the dietary changes were significantly less nutrient dense, less supportive of a healthy lifestyle. And so, you know, I do want to get into the facilities. I want to get into, you know, what we need to know while we're working at the gym. But for a trainer to have a sense of responsibility that my job is important, so important, in fact, that I'm essential during this entire crisis. So what can you tell us about the links between physical activity and those symptoms, the signs, and the actual how people react when they're exposed to COVID-19?
Okay. Well, and I think that's a great point. If we kind of go back a little bit to the beginning of 2020, Rick, where the pandemic just hit, if you remember, a lot of the government agencies, the CDC, even the WHO, they closed down every environment that's going to bring people together. And that's when the gym industry really shuttered, if we remember, right? So remember. During that time, though, a lot of us healthcare professionals, which includes fitness, we were going back to the research and we were looking and saying, wait a second, you know, exercise is the best medicine. And we've all known that. But it because this virus was so new to the earth, remember, the other five pandemics was influenza, was a flu. This is the first pandemic that we have this brand new virus. So we basically only have, you know, maybe 12 to 16 months of research, right? Plus or minus on this virus right now. So it's new to the earth. Per se, right? New to humans. So we didn't have any hardcore data to really support what we've known all along. So a lot of the government agencies, as we all know, were always looking at the metrics, always looking at the data. Well, more so recently, to support what you're saying, is that in my kind of review of the literature, probably the last 6 months, we started seeing the study you quoted and start coming out more. That's supporting the good health and wellness habits that NASM and all of us fitness professionals always promote with our clients. And so more recently, though, we've had some, in my opinion, some large sample studies coming out supporting exactly with what you're saying for that.
So, and one of the reasons this is important, ladies and gentlemen, is because Scott Cheatham is not only a physical therapist, he is a professor at Cal State University?
Yeah, California State, Dominguez Hills. Uh-huh.
Dominguez Hills, right. Yeah, so, and you're in the exercise science or kinesiology department there as assistant professor. These are topics that are vitally important to the student body at which you're addressing. And so, you know, I love this because it's coming from a place of what does the research say? And with that being said, do we have like a large epidemiological study? I know we don't really have any longitudinal studies that are, you know, well, not longer than, you know, 18 months, right? Yeah, 16 months. So what is out there that's providing something that shows that fitness and those fitness outcomes are vitally important to people regarding this particular virus?
Well, what was interesting is out of the United States, a couple months ago, a large study from Salas et al. In the British Journal of Sports Medicine came out, and they looked at physical inactivity among 48,440 to be exact. Okay,
that's a lot of people.
Yeah,
that's
I know. Oh, yeah, like over 48,000 people. They looked at the association of inactivity and high risks for severe COVID-19. And what they found is that the more active individuals who are physically active clearly had less complications from having COVID-19. Okay. And so again, when you look at such a large sample coming from the United States, and this is done at a Kaiser Permanente here in Los Angeles, they looked at that, but if clients met the basic physical fitness, you know, recommendations of, let's say, 150 plus minutes a week or whatever, being active, they had far less symptoms than someone who was sedentary. And we started seeing that, as I mentioned, 6 months ago. When the smaller studies started coming out. So this was the first large scale study that showed the correlation between physical exercise and immunity and health. Now, we can't extrapolate more than what the study looked at, if we remember that. We can't over extrapolate and say, oh, everyone's going to be healthy. No, we're not saying that. What we're saying is that there's a very strong correlation, okay? A statistical significant correlation between physical exercise, some type of immunity that we're still learning, and lower decreased risk of symptoms of COVID-19. So that means the respiratory symptoms, all the neurological symptoms, all those common signs and symptoms that you noted in your podcast, people who exercise seem to have less. And to me, I think that's profound because it's something that we were barking about in the beginning of saying, wait a second, why are you closing all the gyms down when we know that it's the best medicine? Now, I get the transmission rate and the indoor closures. There's a lot of unknowns. I respect that as a healthcare professional. But as a fitness professional, when I train my clients, they need to stay physically active to stay healthy. And we knew that, but this is the first large-scale study that is giving us some preliminary support. We just have to wait a little bit longer till we start getting in more longitudinal data to show that, you know, 6 months out, 1 year out, that the efficacy of this practice. But also on another note, though, we're starting to see other studies from around the world coming up with similar findings. And just in May 21st, it was published online, there was a study out of Brazil, and Brazilian researchers looked at a sample of around 1,000 people in Brazil from like June 2020 to August 2020. Correct. And they use the same methods. Does exercise reduce all the long-term effects of COVID-19? And they found basically the same findings, that just kind of in general, if people are more physically active, like let's say, for example, 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity or 75 minutes of vigorous intensity, you know, kind of those ACSM guidelines, if people follow that, okay, they had a 34% reduction in prevalence of symptoms and stuff. So we're starting to see that exercise could correlate with some type of immunity strengthening. I'm not sure yet.
Right.
But we're starting to see these larger scale studies come from around the world supporting the efficacy of exercise. And I think for the fitness industry, because we've been hit so hard, this is finally some support that we can show all the government agencies to say, look, exercise is going to be the best medicine. And I believe that the future studies that are coming up will support it more and more. So you can see I get fired up, man, because, you know, I love our industry. I love what we're trying to do with people, but we need to exercise.
Absolutely.
And I told people at the beginning of the podcast, I'm going to tell you on this one, this conversation is not to point out flaws in what took place. The conversation isn't to downplay the significance of COVID-19 or the decisions that were made to close gyms and facilities. None of that. The purpose of what this conversation is to show what physical activity can do for those that either have COVID-19 or in prevention. I mean, if you get it, you get it, but it's the symptoms that you have, the signs that you have, the how long it tends to stay. And it's not a silver bullet. That's the other thing. Like, I exercise so I won't get sick. And that's not true. I have a friend and colleague who is in the fitness industry that got it severely and ended up being admitted to the hospital. And he's young and he's fit, and it's not a silver bullet. So when Dr. Cheatham talks about there's a correlation and there's something about physical activity and the immune system and the individual and how it's supportive, then we have to put all of those things together and understand that the physical activity is showing a significant correlation in a relative risk about how well people that are relatively fit, or at least those that exercise. Because remember, you can be, quote, in shape. You can look the part, but there are a lot of people that just kind of comes naturally to. So it does actually have to be someone that, you know, there's actual physical activity that's taking place. Now, one more thing to speak to is, and I'll let you go in on this, Scott, is what seems to many people to be at an arbitrary number, 150 minutes of moderate intensity and 75 minutes of vigorous intensity, which I talked about a little bit. It's not arbitrary. It's based on actually a lot of studies throughout the years. And the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is really going in on this and focusing a lot on this 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise weekly. Can you speak to those numbers for a little bit? What does that mean? What is moderate intensity? What is vigorous intensity? And is this something that, I guess, like, is it overwhelming to a lot of people, especially that are sedentary, to take on? Or is there a different perspective we should shift people toward a little bit?
Yeah. So I think a couple things, and I think I wanted to touch on your prior point is that, you know, hopefully with our conversation, we're kind of talking about, you know, our personal thoughts and stuff. But again, you know, everybody here in the United States, even the CDC and the WHO, we're all doing the best we can. And so hopefully my apologies if we came across strong, but we're just kind of giving how we feel as far as the love for fitness and the love for people. So we're really kind of sharing our thoughts on prevention and stuff with overall versus criticizing in particular.
Right. And you weren't. I just want to be clear with that. Yeah, I wanted to make that statement.
Yeah.
That
and I agree too, because I think we've all been affected, all of our listeners and stuff. So it's tough not to kind of be perfect with things because we've been through so much. But I think now that we're kind of climbing out of this, it's exciting. And so when we talk specifically though, and we transition to physical activity and stuff like that, a lot of times when we talk about, you know, moderate, you know, the 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity to or 75 minutes of vigorous intensity, if you do look at some of the guidelines and stuff, there is some interpretation when it comes to each individual client. And I think that's important because we can look at the American College of Sports Medicine guidelines. We can look at, you know, Department of Health guidelines, and they may define moderate activity differently. It depends if it's cardiorespiratory or if it's resistance training, right? Or they'll just say that basically you have to move with a certain, you know, measured by a certain RPE or a certain heart rate. Now, the caveat to that is if you are working with a post-COVID-19 client and they might be a long hauler and they do have some of these longer term symptoms, their moderate activity is going to have to be modified for what that they can do. So currently I have several patients that are long haulers, and moderate activity for them may be less than someone who's healthy right now. So I think it's important to put that in context that the guidelines are open to interpretation, you know, and we obviously know that if we follow some type of, you know, if we follow the heart rate or the pulse rate kind of scales and stuff, we're looking at that 60%, you know, to 75 or whatever. We're looking at those moderate ranges for stuff, but it has to be modified with the long haulers. And I think that that's something important because the four patients I have right now that I'm working with, they have respiratory and neurological problems. So it's a lot different to get them to be physically durable to handle, you know, that 150 minutes a week. So it's gonna have to be modified. And I know in the course we covered it, and I know in your podcast you covered it, but when you're really working with the client, it really warrants one-to-one monitoring all the way through because they can get symptoms throughout their workout. It's very interesting. This disease process is challenging.
So can you talk us through some of the long haul symptoms? Because I think many of us know or are familiar that there are people that are these quote long haulers. I have a very good friend of mine in the fitness industry that is a long hauler. Can you go through some, certainly I don't expect an exhaustive list, but what can we expect with somebody that has these long haul symptoms?
Well, you know, some of the hallmark, at least that I've, you know, kind of encapsulated just simply speaking and stuff. When we talk about some of the long-term symptoms and stuff like that, the five most common are going to be, you know, fatigue, headache, attention disorder, hair loss, and shortness of breath. Okay. Those are the five that are mostly in there. Now, what I've seen among my, because I'm really doing more sports medicine with the athletes who have it. Yeah. I have some older athletes and I have some younger ones. The common thing is the attention disorder. It's really interesting. It's almost like they call it COVID fog. They have some cognition issues and some attention span issues where they just can't concentrate. It's almost like a concussion. So it's really challenging. The second thing is the shortness of the breath and the fatigue. Those are the two biggest ones that I'm personally seeing. And I think most of the healthcare professionals, like the orthopedic surgeons and stuff that I interact with, and also the fitness professionals that I kind of have in my network, we're seeing those two commonalities of the respiratory and the neurological attention deficits.
Fascinating. Thank you. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. Scott Cheatham. And Dr. Scott Cheatham is an assistant professor at Cal State University, Dominguez Hills. He is a licensed physical therapist, and he is a subject matter expert that has worked with the NASM on multiple projects. And we are lucky to have him as a subject matter expert on our behalf. And we're talking right now about COVID-19. We're talking about physical activity. We're talking about the fitness industry, and there are really vitally important things that we need to familiarize ourselves with, including the importance of physical activity, having our clients do what they can, not what they can't. And so if that means we're trying to get somebody to do the 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise, but that's not something they can do, maybe they've got the fatigue, they've got the either respiratory issues continuing, this COVID fog, limiting their ability to focus or make those definitive decisions to move their body. And when they do, it's particularly challenging for many of the long haulers because of the fatigue that is associated. And I know this very well from conversations with a friend of mine that has some severe long haul symptoms, who is a fitness professional. So with that being said, I want to talk not just about the physical activity, but talk about the spaces in the fitness environment. What do we know about the gyms, their safety? Is it okay for people to be in a gym close to other people and exercising? So are we doing something good in a place that is bad, right? Like in terms of COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus. So is it a place where spread does tend to happen? Because early on, I haven't heard anything about it since the shutdown happened, but there were news articles popping up everywhere, like super spreader. This is a super spreader event, and gyms were always listed in there. So what do we know about gyms and SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, and what do we know that we need to do at these facilities to help protect people that are in attendance?
Yeah, I mean, that's, Rick, I love it. You're always asking me the tough questions. And well, you know, as everyone knows, like, as you said, when the pandemic first hit, you know, and we started rolling into the beginning, you know, Q1 and Q2 of 2020, fitness facilities, studios, gyms, everything was named as the top two or three transmissible environments. Mm-hmm. We realize though, that it's mainly from the respiratory droplets, right? And that's where the transmission occurs. There's a few studies that came out across the world, a couple in Asia, I think one in Australia, and then maybe one from the United States that had more like sports teams get it, right? You know, they had like a COVID breakout, like at high schools, they had a COVID breakout, let's say with like a club hockey team, you know, ice hockey team. They had a couple of these things or dance studios, which if you look at the studies, and this is an important point, that they only looked at the team itself and the transmission. They didn't look at any of the what's called extraneous variables. We don't know where the kids were before or after. We don't know if people were tested before or after. So there's all these variables, and all of a sudden they put a stamp on it and said, oh, if you get a group together, including a gym, right, or a dance studio or anything, you're going to get COVID. But those studies were flawed in many levels because they didn't say, well, did someone come in infected, right? So as far as my knowledge so far, as a researcher and as a practicing PT and fitness professional, I have not seen any clear evidence that has showed a link between people working out in a gym and then it's spreading everywhere. Does that make sense? And so... I'm sure you as being a doctor yourself, have you seen anything that I've Do you agree with me? Have you seen anything that has come across that's so compelling that we can't?
No, and it's interesting. One of the reasons I ask that, because I know that you may be looking into the research more specifically about this because of your particular practice, but for me also as a gym owner, I'm looking into it. I'm trying to figure out what these correlations are. I certainly understand that we can't control every variable. And so at any given point, I would assume somebody in the facility has COVID-19, right? Like you just need to assume that. So one of the things that we did, and it was state mandated, but it would have been mandated by our facility itself, is that we required people wearing masks. And early on, especially, that was, I mean, we're in New York City, and New York City got hurt bad.
Yeah.
And people are ready to wear masks, but they weren't quite ready to wear them at the gym. So there were some, you know, fight's not the right word, but you understand where I'm coming from. Like we were trying to really get serious conversations with people and inviting them to leave our facility if they weren't wearing masks, because we knew it was the respiratory droplets, and we needed to contain those things. And New York did end up doing quite well. And at this point, I think 70% of the population in New York has gotten either one dose or at least one dose of the vaccine. And we no longer are required to wear a mask at the gym if you're fully vaccinated. So things are changing at this point. And you know, but there were a lot of things that went on within the facility. So whether or not there was a correlation, I just said, pretend somebody in the gym, just anybody, you look left to right, one of these people has it. What do you need to do? And of course, we were very particular about everything with the MERV 13 or higher, with the filtration system. We got additional filtration systems, air purifiers in the facility. We had UV lights put up throughout the facility. Couldn't drink water out of a water fountain. You could fill a cup up if you wanted to do that. Staying 6 feet apart from people unless you were spotting somebody. And what else? Oh, if you needed to take your mask off to drink said water, then we would require that the trainer move 15 feet away from that person and ensure that nobody else came within 15 feet of that person. Now, we were real particular because we got hit really quite hard. And here's the other thing, Scott. I didn't want a single case to come back to independent training spot. I didn't want anybody to be, you know, here we're beginning the process of contact tracing and to look back and go, that's the gym that didn't follow the rules and somebody got sick and then a lot of people got sick. So we went a little bit above and beyond with everything that we could in order to provide safety for every person that was there. And for us, it was valuable. You talk about doing the right thing for doing the sake of the right thing. And there are numerous people that feel that this is fear mongering. But at the same time, I look at it, I'm like, we don't know a lot about this, but we know a lot of people are dead because of it. A lot of people are severely injured. And myself as a type 2 diabetic, I was like, I'm going to go into the gym. My gym better be clean because I don't want to get in. Like I'm one of those populations that could be, could have significant results, adverse results if I were to be exposed to it. So I needed to treat everybody as if I was treating myself, my mom, whomever it is that I care about. And so we made big strides to do the best we can and better. Did it turn some people off? Sure. But we were the safest we could be, to the point that we were invited as guests for a New York City Department of Health thing for the fitness industry so that we could explain some of the things that we did. Got so this was important to us. And this is kind of where we're talking about what's our connection with this and understanding more about COVID-19 and really how this course of information developed that NASM has regarding COVID-19 and understanding a bit more about how do we manage this pathology, this disease within the realm of what we deal with. So COVID-19 management, and that course I think is going to be really valuable for a lot of people. Two reasons, Scott. One is that you as a fitness professional can feel more comfortable. And two, and this what I would say is most important for your business, is so that your clients can feel more comfortable with you and the environment they are about to enter, because you have armed yourself with the information to help support a facility, a place, an individual that has learned and knows and is familiar about how to manage some of the circumstances surrounding this highly contagious and obviously at this point a very, very deadly disease. And again, pushback on that, Scott, right? Because people will give their information. Well, it's not that deadly if you look at this and this, but with 500,000 people dead in the United States alone, including some very good friend of mine, you know, these are not things just to say, I'm going to put my stake in the ground and say it doesn't affect me or anybody else, because it does. And it's been hard. And I guess for me in New York City in particular, and you in Southern California, so you guys were hit really hard too, just based on population spread rapidly. But we were early on affected, and affected hard. And so a lot of my colleagues in New York feel a little better about these very careful means of how we work with and around this particular pathology that comes through this virus. And there are other people who don't feel the same way. And I get it, because it's hard to accept something that you haven't been directly affected by. But it's caught on around the world and even into small towns. So I just think it's very important for us to understand some of these things.
Well, and Rick, if I may add too, I think it boils down to two themes, right? Your question before, you asked me, you know, kind of what's the latest research. So I kind of gave the compelling argument as far as a researcher, right? There really isn't any substantial research yet that has showed a correlation between, you know, major indoor environments, gyms, et cetera. But also though too, as you mentioned, what I've done a lot of the same practices in my gym facility here in California and with my patients ever since the beginning of COVID, because I've been treating the whole time, because I have post-surgical patients who are very vulnerable, right? And a lot of them have comorbidities, et cetera. But to me, that brings more to a second theme called best practices, right? And as you know too, I can talk about the research so I'm blue in the face, but we don't know anything. This whole pandemic is only 1 year old. It's a 1 year old baby. We don't know nothing. And so with best practices, we have to be able to isolate the virus by, you know, having masks on, by having social distancing, by cleaning everything, cleaning surfaces, and doing what we know that have worked in the last five pandemics. Because until we know anything different, we have to go with best practices. And I think because of, you know, because of the confusion that have occurred at the beginning of the pandemic, because we didn't really know how to handle it as a human race, there was a lot of confusion. But I think fast forward now, and as we've gotten used to it over a year, everyone kind of accepted the point of, and the logic behind all these preventative strategies of best practices. And until the research supports it or the data, then we're not going to see a lot of change, especially in some states. And we saw that in California, because California, I believe humbly, we have tons of people vaccinated now, and we saw the rates drop completely, right? And I think as of this week, we may be to the lowest tier where we don't have to wear masks except for indoors. Like we're really kind of to that normal. So something had to happen in California. The only link we can see is vaccinations. So hopefully that has helped, along with better best practices of wearing your mask. If you're not feeling good, don't go out in public. Just your basics, Right. So I think we still have to follow that as professionals, because our duty as fitness professionals is also to protect our clients. Right.
You know,
and we still have to take care of them. So again, there's so many unknowns, and, you know, you could see I have a lot of passion because I've had a few patients pass away from COVID. So, you know, we've had personal experiences, but I'm just glad that we're starting to get a handle on things, and hopefully we'll learn from this whole experience.
I think you did us a great justice by pointing out best practices, because when you don't have the research, you do have to go with what the best practices are based off of what we previously have been exposed to. And there have been other times where we've experienced a pandemic or an epidemic that spikes in a certain area that we need to protect it so it doesn't expand beyond an epidemic. And so these best practices are things that get put in place, and you can look at it and say, well, we don't have any research yet. Well, that's why you need to be careful. Like, there are things we know, and there are the numbers and the infections and the deaths. There are things we don't know, like what are all the variables that are leading to it, and what's the best way to protect. We just work on best practices until the research catches up. And I've really enjoyed talking to you about some of the research that is catching up regarding physical activity and COVID-19. That's very important. One more thing before we sign off, I want to talk to you about is some of the, the monitoring. What are we looking at? What are some of the things that you were talking about? You mentioned the oximeter, right? So the pulse oximeter and some of the other kind of movement devices that people utilize. How is that useful in helping to support people in this process, and particularly fitness professionals working with clients that have COVID-19 or have had it, or long haulers, that stuff?
Yeah. Well, from the research side, there's a ton of studies going out right now looking at heart rate variability. They're looking at sympathetic responses to, you know, because obviously if you're not feeling good, you're in pain, or you're having, you know, labored breathing, and you're having respiratory issues, or you're a long hauler, obviously your sympathetic nervous system is going to be on. So they're looking at some type of sympathetic dysregulation. So they're looking at all these metrics and stuff. At least in my practice, when I'm working with my long haulers who are athletic and stuff, and we're trying to get them going, a couple things I do is I like to use the pulse oximeter, which is the little finger sensor. I like to use that during the first, let me see if I have one here. Oop, nope, I don't. I thought I had it with me. But anyways, the pulse oximeter registers your oxygen levels. And so I'll usually take that throughout their workout. If I'm working with a client who has some type of respiratory issues, either related to COVID-19 or not, and usually 95 to 100% is considered normal saturation. So that means that the respiration, right, the air is getting in our lungs, right, and also diffusion, the oxygen is getting through the alveoli into the bloodstream. So that's what it's measuring. And so if I'm exercising somebody and they're dropping below, you know, 95 and getting into the lower things, we may have them rest and do some type of breathing exercises to get the oxygen back up before we
continue.
Yeah. So in one of my, and then there's was also some clinicians use the pulse oximeter to measure people who have COVID-19. So for example, one of my friends who's an infectious disease doctor, one of their children got sick. They used the pulse oximeter. It dropped below, well, the lowest clinical is about 93. Usually if you get towards 90, you're in trouble and you're having really respiratory issues and you're not getting enough oxygen. Mm-hmm. So their daughter, it started dropping in the low 90s. They rushed him to the ER, where the doctor obviously were able to take care of them. And then they administered a lot of the breathing and respiratory therapy so that they wouldn't get into respiratory arrest. So
wow.
So that, So that's one thing we can do clinically that we kind of monitor and all that throughout. And I think that's where the pulse oximeter does come in. Now, the pulse oximeter also is pretty accurate. It does measure pulse rate. So you can measure their pulse rate and you can measure their pulse rate response, because we know with a post-COVID patient, their rate of perceived exertion is going to increase linearly with their pulse rate, also with their systolic blood pressure, and some sources talk about the diastolic, but I kind of look at more the systolic. So those metrics can be monitored throughout their exercises. So basically, like every 10 minutes or every 15 minutes, I'll stop my client. They'll take a break in between the little circuits or something. Then I'll put the pulse oximeter on, and then I'll ask for an RPE, and I document it. So then that helps me every session to hopefully their exercise tolerance will increase, and I can progress them based on those metrics as well as the assessment and the reassessment throughout.
Nice. And the pulse oximeter, for people who are looking at these things, I don't think that they're particularly expensive. That if you needed to look at something, it's just a little finger thing that clamps on the finger. We had them at one of our facilities at one point, and it was not an expensive purchase. So it might be a consideration for you to get if you do have clients, long haul clients in particular. So again, everything today is for your consideration.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And they're cheap on some of the other websites like Amazon or something. I've seen them cheap. And
The
one I bought, I got it for 3 easy payments in $19.99, and I even got a set of steak knives. No, I'm kidding. That was a joke for everybody. It's my.
There's some people out there like, which steak knives?
Yeah, exactly. Ginsu, remember the cool steak knives? Yeah. I'm just having fun.
Is there anything that you have that maybe we should speak to before we close this out that you think anybody else needs to know? Maybe some information about the course that is being offered that anybody needs to know. What can you share with us?
Yeah, so I believe NASM is offering the course. I believe it's still free at this point. So people can download the course, and I think it's an easy PDFs that people can do. And I'm hoping that everyone would, because there's a lot of great best practices in there, as well as a blending of the current research. And I think, you know, Rick, we kind of did both sides, which I like, because that's why I love being on the podcast, because with your education and your wealth of knowledge, we kind of do both, right? We talk a little bit about the research, which is more controversial because we don't know anything about COVID. We're still learning. But then we talk about best practices that is what we know is starting to work. And so I think the course over 6 chapters gives the fitness professional kind of a compendium of topics that cover the latest on stuff, you know, and so hopefully everyone will enjoy that reading. And so I enjoyed it because I learned so much, because I dove into hundreds of studies, and it's an enormous amount, but I think we're able to filter it in a nice little package. So
Well done, Scott. Thank you so much. And for those of you who don't know, Dr. Scott Cheatham is an assistant professor of kinesiology at Cal State University Dominguez Hills, and he is a subject matter expert for the National Academy of Sports Medicine. He's been a regular on the show, and we're always happy to have you, Scott. So thank you for taking time out of your day to be with us and kind of share your expertise and the information that you have regarding this particular topic.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to the NASM family and everyone listening. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Absolutely. Do you have social media, anything?
You know, I'm old school. DrScottWCheatham.com is my website. It's a kind of my own personal website. They can contact me through there or my university, or I'm on Facebook. So pretty.
Excellent. Scott Cheatham, thank you so much for being on today. And everybody, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you. And just remember, we're taking time to really inform and develop, refine, and we're trying to get fitness professionals to feel better about exercise, human movement science, metabolic health, coaching, and business. So thanks so much for listening. Give us a listen, like, share, subscribe, and review. My name is Rick Ritchie. You can hit me up at dr.rickritchie at NASM. Oh, dr.rickritchie on Instagram, or rick.ritchie at nasm.org. This has been the NASM CPT Podcast.